We'll be reading this morning from Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 to 13. You can find it on page 1235 of the Pew Bibles. Page 1235. It's Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia, write, these are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. I will make those who are of the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars, I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Since you have kept my command to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come upon the whole world to test those who live on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have, so that no one will take your crown. Him who overcomes, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will he leave it. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. And I will also write on him my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.
You may have seen in the news this last weekend, a man called Russell Cook. He's just become the first person to run the length of Africa in 352 days. You're not mishearing me. He ran over 10,000 miles, crossing 16 countries from South Africa to Tunisia. And as you may like to imagine, he faced plenty of challenges along the way. But last weekend, that's him finally finishing his marathon run. Well, I say marathon. It was over 285 marathons this man has just run. And apparently one of the things that kept him going, I wonder if you were to guess what it was, what that might be. The thing he said he was most looking forward to, running for nearly a year, over 200 marathons. What's the one thing he really looks forward to? A strawberry daiquiri. Now, for the uninitiated such as myself, that's a cocktail of rum, lime and strawberries. Of all the things that might keep you going, a strawberry cocktail. I would need a lot more than that to look forward to if I was ever to embark on such a feat. I'd need a lot more than that if I was ever to think about going for a jog. But that's what he was looking forward to. As you may well know, the Christian life following Jesus is likened to running a marathon. It is an endurance endeavor. That's because following Jesus will require perseverance, a keeping going through good times as well as bad. When Jesus pictures his followers, he pictures them carrying a cross, not a sun lounger. See, following Jesus requires a keeping on, all the way to the finish line. So it is, when we find things tough, maybe you've experienced it, where you have a question that pops into your mind. When life's just frankly a bit rubbish, is following Jesus really worth it? When someone's giving me a hard time for what I believe, is it worth keeping on? Well, I think the situation in the church in Philadelphia that we're looking at today reveals to us that those in the church there, they're beginning to flag. They're beginning to flounder. They're feeling weary. Perhaps as Anna read it for us, you spotted how Jesus knows, verse 8, their little strength. He knows they've kept his word. He knows they've not denied his name. He knows, verse 10, they're enduring patiently. And therefore, he asks of them only one thing in verse 11, hold on. Hold on to what you have. The church in Philadelphia is a church family that's tired, that's weary, that's struggling. They are faithful but flagging. And it's to this church, Jesus offers no correction, no condemnation, simply that they hold on, that they keep on holding on to him. But in order to help them, Jesus piles up a number of wonderful pictures to remind them of all that is to come, all that they have to look forward to, all that has been promised to them as his people. And I think it's way better than a strawberry daiquiri. You can tell me at the end whether you agree or not. But here's why we should all want to hear what Jesus has to say this morning. It may not be that we're facing the sort of persecution that the church in Philadelphia were 2,000 years ago. Although I do know a number of us are facing real challenges at the moment. Maybe that question's in our minds. Is it really worth holding on? But even if not, these verses will still help us, both in preparation and in prayer. First of all, in preparation. You see, sooner or later, if we are a follower of Jesus, we will find it tough growing. That cross can be very heavy to bear. And so what Jesus says here will be of huge help then. It'll help us be prepared. It'll also help us pray. Each month at our prayer supper, as we will this Wednesday, we take time to pray for a country on the Open Doors World Watch List. That is a country where we pray in particular for the Christian sisters and brothers in that country who are at this very moment being persecuted for trusting in Jesus. So hearing what Jesus has to say here will help us knowing what to pray for them. May I also just add to that, if you're here this morning, you wouldn't yet call yourself a Christian. I hope you'll find this helpful too, not only in being realistic about what it means to follow Jesus, but also why it really is worth it, why he really is worth it. But as always, let's first consider the description of Jesus that we have, as we do at the beginning of every letter. If you've closed your Bibles, you might want to follow along. Page 1235, Revelation 3 and verse 7. It's Jesus speaking. Hopefully by now we know that whilst what is written is always true of Jesus at the beginning of each letter, what we have at the beginning of each letter is particularly pertinent to the people Jesus is directly addressing. So as we hear Jesus' description of himself, we should be thinking, well, how is this going to help the church in Philadelphia? This brings us to our first heading, who Jesus is. Jesus holds the key of David and the door is always open. Jesus in verse 7 is described as holy, set apart, pure, divine, holy and true. That is authentic as opposed to false or fake. In other words, the picture of Jesus, he is the God, he's holy, whom we can trust because he's true. His motives aren't skewed by sinful desires as ours might be. He's holy. His words aren't spun or shaped by pride or wanting to preserve oneself or reputation. He is true. We can trust what Jesus says. And in particular, we can trust what Jesus says here about opening doors. That Jesus holding the key of David in verse 7 may seem a little obscure at first, but the phrase comes from the Old Testament, as so many of the pictures in Revelation do. It's from the book of Isaiah and concerns a chap called Eliakim, where he is given the power by the king, King Hezekiah, the power and authority of the king. And it's symbolized by the key to the having a key placed on his shoulders. Let me show you the Bible verse. That'll help. I will place on his shoulder the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. Rings bells, doesn't it, with what we see in Revelation 3. Eliakim is basically made second in command, given great power and authority. He holds the key of the king, King David. What he says goes. His decision is final. You don't argue with what he says because you see the key of David on his shoulder. How wonderful then that when we get to Revelation chapter 3, the one who now holds the key of David is the one who is holy and true. I don't need to convince you that a locked shut door presents a problem if it's a door that you actually want to go through. But in verse 8, Jesus' emphasis is on a door not being shut, but being opened, that no one can then shut. Which begs the question, doesn't it? What then is the door? Well, just over the page at the beginning of chapter 4, as John's vision continues, there is an open door. And it is the open door giving access to heaven. It is the door to God's kingdom, the door to where God dwells. And Jesus is here saying, look, I have the key. I've opened that door and it will stay open. To stretch the metaphor, if I may, we know that the key in Jesus' hand is, of course, the cross where Jesus died. It was demonstrated when he died. Think back to that first Easter weekend. As Jesus cries his last breath, the curtain in the temple is torn in two from top to bottom, we're told in the Gospels. That was that thick curtain that separated where God symbolically dwelt, the Holy of Holies, separated everyone else in the temple from God. You couldn't go through that curtain. But when Jesus died, the curtain was torn in two from top to bottom. No more separation, no more of a barrier. Well, in Revelation 3 language, the door was unlocked once and for all. For what Jesus has opened, no one can shut. And if only I'd have spoken to Marilyn earlier. She's got a wonderful picture of this on her phone. The church where she was meeting in the US last week. Forgive me if I get any of the details wrong, Marilyn. But you'll see in the photo, there's a big cross, which is a massive window. And she asked me this morning, how do you get into the building? And the door is at the bottom of the cross. You enter at the foot of the cross. It's a brilliant illustration, isn't it? The door that Jesus opened, the key is the cross, and all may go in. No one's going to shut that door, is Jesus' point. That is good news for the Philadelphian Christians, because in verse 8 we see that they're faithful. They have kept Jesus' word. They're not denying his name. They are faithfully holding on, but they're flagging. They have little strength. It's good news for them. It's good news for us as well. Jesus holds the key. The door is open and no one's going to shut it. The door is still open. But as we read on, we see in verse 9, we can build up something of we get a sense of something of the challenge that the Philadelphian Christians were facing. That phrase, the synagogue of Satan, we've come across it once before in the second letter back in chapter 2. Jesus is not saying that those in the synagogue are worshipping the Satan. He's referring to a group from the synagogue who, like the Satan, the Satan means the accuser. That's what the word means. Described as the father of lies. Well, these people are lying in what they say about the Philadelphian Christians. In the accusations they make, they are false. Given the language of the letter, it's possible that this church of little strength, they have literally had the door to the synagogue shut, slammed shut, literally and metaphorically. You don't belong here. You're a Christian. You're not one of us. God doesn't love you. Your naming Jesus as Lord just shows you're not part of God's chosen people. You're not welcome here. Go away. Door to the synagogue shut. And along with that physical door closing, their freedom to practice Christianity as a permitted religion in Philadelphia and the exemption from imperial cult activities, well, those exemptions and freedoms would have been shut as well. So facing that sort of alienation in the town where you live, coupled with a desire to keep Jesus' word, to not deny his name, no, Caesar's not Lord, Jesus is. We begin to get a sense of why these Christians have had to patiently endure. But this letter is one of encouragement, isn't it? That no matter what doors the synagogue may close on you, no matter what privileges that you may have to forfeit, it is worth holding on to Jesus, because there is one door, and frankly, it's the only door that really matters. The door to our Father in heaven. And that door, says Jesus, I've opened it, I've placed it open before you, and no one can close it. Jesus is holy and true. Jesus holds the key of David, and he has opened the door to heaven. But as if that wasn't enough encouragement, Jesus gives them three further assurances in what he then goes on to say. Secondly, what does Jesus say? Well, firstly, know that I love you. The picture at the end of verse 9 is one of victory, defeated enemies bowing before the victor. It's taken from the Old Testament, again from the book of Isaiah, where God's people Israel are promised that God will give them victory over their enemies. But strikingly, Jesus takes that picture of those bowing to Israel and he applies it to this little strength church family in Philadelphia, reminding them that they are actually truly God's people. How through their trust in Jesus, God really has accepted them, no matter what those in the synagogue may say. This is actually one of the many reminders we have in the New Testament of how the privileges and promises given to Old Testament Israel are inherited by the Christian church. But did you notice as to why this takes place? It's not just victory, it's vindication. All will acknowledge, says Jesus, that I have loved you. You don't have to have had someone slam the door in your face to know that's generally a sign of rejection. Given their circumstances, it's not hard for us to see why this handful of believers in Philadelphia might question if they really are loved by God. By all accounts, the synagogue was massive, over 1,000 people in it. And them closing the door. Does God really love me? Is Jesus really worth it? And let's not forget one of the most precious promises of God in the Old Testament to the nation of Israel. What does he say? He says this: the Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest, but it was because the Lord loved you. To be Israel was to be God's chosen, loved people. Well, here now, Jesus, the one who is holy and true, can spot the lies of those who say this little strength church community in Philadelphia are not God's people, that God could never love them. Jesus reminds them they are dearly loved, and their future vindication will be proof of that. Hear the words of the one who is holy and true: I love you. But Jesus doesn't stop there. There's more. Know that I will keep you. As Jesus reflects on their remaining faithful to him, keeping his command to endure, keeping running the race, so he reminds them of his promise to keep them. Now, there's some debate as to what Jesus is referring to in the rest of verse 10. He could be referring to the trials and testings described in the rest of the book of Revelation that seem to repeat from generation to generation, one way or another. In that sense, the hour of trial started when Jesus ascended to heaven and finishes when Jesus returns. And so, knowing that they have little strength left, Jesus assures them that he will keep them. He will keep them through these trials. He will hold them fast, as we sing. That doesn't mean life will necessarily be easy. And of course, they can already testify to the truth of how it's not. But it does mean that though they are weak, they will, as it were, reach the finish line. It could mean that. I think it's probably more likely that Jesus is referring to what happens at the end of the book of Revelation, when he returns in glory and he winds up history, as it were. Then the whole world will bow the knee before him. And that fits very much with verse 9. They will be kept safe on that day. They have nothing to fear on that final day. But in both those scenarios, both of which are biblically true, the point remains the same, doesn't it? Jesus will keep them. Whatever the hour of trial may be, whatever testing may look like, they can be sure that they're safe. They can be sure they will be kept. I guess you're familiar with what's known as a Roman handshake, rather than just hand to hand. It's where you sort of, I don't know if you have to be wearing a centurion's outfit to do it, but you sort of grasp the forearms. Seen that in the movies? Watch Gladiators. It's always how they greet one another. But I remember many years ago, someone said, Andy, what you need to remember is this is how Jesus has you. And even though you may let go of him at times, he will never let go of you. That's the promise Jesus gives to the church in Philadelphia. Keep holding on. Even if you find it hard to hold on, even if it's by your fingernails at times, I will never let go of you. Jesus says, I will keep you safe. Hear the words of the one who is holy and true. I love you. I will keep you. And finally, know that you belong to my God. So we've been thinking those slandered or cut off by others That would no doubt take its toll at times. We can say, oh, water off a duck's back, but sometimes it does get to you. That closed synagogue door reminding them they're not welcome, that there's no place for them there, that they do not belong, not today, not ever. Well, in these last couple of verses, Jesus' final encouragement moves us from standing outside the synagogue door to inside the temple. And that is very significant indeed. In the paper this week, I came across this little building. I'd not heard of them before, but apparently there are still 13 of these Victorian-built shelters in existence around London, where for many years they've provided a place for London cabbies to gather and to rest. And this is the last one of them to be given protected status. It's actually nicknamed the chapel. But were you to step inside of any of these little green huts, you could rightly expect to find in there a London cabbie or two. Well, the heavenly temple that Jesus describes here, were we to step inside there, we could rightly expect to find God himself. This is where he lives. This is where the people gather to worship him. This heavenly temple in Revelation 3 is God's dwelling place. And he's not alone, is he? It's where God dwells, but also where each and every member of this little strength church in Philadelphia, well, there'll be a pillar, firm, established. It's a picture of permanent residence. Philadelphia at the time, like many other towns in the region, had suffered quite badly through numerous earthquakes. So much so that the city had to be rebuilt a couple of times, and each time it was given a new name. Although it seems those new names never quite stuck, and historically people still refer to it as Philadelphia rather than Neo Caesarea or something else. But so nervous apparently were some of the residents that even though they had homes in the city, at night they'd go and sleep out in the countryside under the stars for fear of a roof collapsing on their head. Well, here Jesus pictures his followers as unshakable pillars in the temple, in the very dwelling place of God himself. And verse 12, they will never leave. They will never leave. So the picture Jesus finishes with is one of permanent place of belonging for every follower of Jesus with God himself in his temple. Synagogue door may be shut, but look at the door that Jesus opens. And just so we don't miss the fact of this sense of belonging, it's underlined, written in bold, and put in capital letters by the naming we will each receive. You might have put a name in a school bag or a school jumper to show who it belongs to. Well, here, Jesus says the Christian who holds on is given three names so there could be no doubting who we belong to. The synagogue may say, oh, you don't belong. Jesus says, no, you really do. So whatever sniping may come from the synagogue, you're not God's people. God doesn't love you. You don't belong here. Jesus reminds them then and us today that it really is worth holding on to. It really is worth keeping on in the Christian faith. For whilst our feeling weak may be different from the reasons the church were going through then, are struggling to keep holding on, maybe because of different circumstances we are facing. Well, these truths, these promises are for all God's people everywhere. Let he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. This isn't just for the church in Philadelphia. It's for the church family in Arborfield too. Jesus has opened the door. Jesus loves you. Jesus will keep you. You will belong to God, my God, says Jesus, forever and ever. Let's have a moment's quiet, opportunity to think about that, or maybe pray quietly in your own head. And then just in a few moments' time, the music will start. And please, can I encourage you to stand and sing together?